This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll look at progress made to contain malaria, a disease that kills nearly 600,000 people, mostly children in Africa, a year after vaccines were first rolled out in several countries.
We know from the pilot programs that have taken place so far that children who receive the vaccine, we see a 13% drop in overall child mortality and an even higher reduction in the number of children who, when given the vaccine, are hospitalised in the first place.
And Benin is determined to give citizenship to the descendants of African slaves. But is there interest?
I absolutely love Benin. My partner and I went. He and I touched down in Benin Republic, and immediately I just had a sense of belonging. I can't really explain that. It really was a spiritual connection.
We hear from someone with first-hand experience. It's Thursday, January 23rd. First, we go to Nigeria. Mobile phone users in Nigeria are about to start paying a whole lot more to make calls, send messages, and use data. This is after the Nigerian Communications Commission, a government body that regulates the telecom industry, agreed to allow mobile and telecommunications operators to increase their tariffs by 50%. This is the first time the prices are going up in Africa's fourth largest economy since 2013. The Commission explained that without the hike, the telecom industry would be at risk of collapse, an argument endorsed by the companies. Not everyone agrees, though. Subscribers have expressed outrage and called the decision unacceptable. My colleague in Lagos, Blessing Aderoba, summed up for me how Nigerians are reacting to this. So, Blessing, what's been the general mood among subscribers in Nigeria regarding this 50% tariff increase?
Okay, Charles, I'll tell you that the mood is one that's really not welcoming, and it's just a feeling of being taxed everywhere. For a Nigerian, there's the increase in electricity, there's also fuel price, and then coupled with food prices and now data and airtime. So it's really not sitting well with Nigerians. And the concern for a lot of Nigerians has always been that, how did my airtime, how did my data finish so fast? And also, the network is so terrible. You go online, people are complaining, network is so terrible. The network is so terrible. So there's that feeling of not getting full value of what you have purchased, and now you want to increase the price. So that's like the feeling. And for a user myself, I spend like $7 for 60 gigabytes data, and that would be like 11,000 naira, which could be less. And that's me trying to get good deals. But at different occasions, I find myself recharging again and doing another data within these 30 days. These are the concerns and that feeling that, why are you increasing the price again? So it's really not welcoming for Nigerians.
But are there particular groups, maybe small business owners or students, people that really need to make that call or use that data for their day-to-day business? And what are they saying? Do they have stronger concerns about how this is going to impact on their communication needs?
Definitely, yes. These are the people that will mostly be affected. There was a time I went for an interview and I had to interview lots of young people. I realized they were turning off their data. And that shows that to get airtime or data, it's not cheap. It's not something that they can easily get, because if they look at the priority of things, there are a lot of things they need to settle. And who is giving them money? Probably their parents, or probably they are trying to do something small to get money, because they need to communicate with friends. And they're always on social media. They're always online. And for some, that's like a source of income for them. And so it's really a concern. And for market women and people in rural areas, they get to call a lot. So the question has always been that, will the service really be better? Are we going to get real value for the purchase? And with a lot of things going on around, things are hard in Nigeria, data and airtime just feels like another burden again. And so that's the feeling, really.
That was my colleague, Blessing Aderoba, in Lagos. It appears that the situation could have been a lot worse for Nigerians, because the telecom operators had lobbied for a 100% hike. They pointed to the rising costs of running businesses in Nigeria, which other sectors of the economy, like aviation, are grappling with. So we got the man who chairs the Association of Licensed Telecom Operators of Nigeria, Benga Adebayo. He started by telling us why this adjustment is happening now.
In the first instance, energy cost has gone up. About a year ago, we used to buy a liter of diesel for 250 naira. Today, that liter of diesel has gone up to 1,200 naira. You can imagine the percentage difference. That's number one. Number two, we face the same economic headwinds as other sectors of the economy. We are not insulated from the socio-economic factors that others are facing. And therefore, ours cannot be a subsidy to mitigate people's impact of the economy on other people's lives. So for us to continue to provide sustainable services, there is a need for us to price right. For our industry to be sustainable, there is a need for us to charge a cost-reflective tariff. And those are the arguments that we have put forward to the regulator. So we cannot operate in isolation of other socioeconomic factors of the country. We are not responsible for energy. We are not responsible for security. We are also not responsible for the problems that the people are facing at large. Those are situations arising from government actions and government decisions. And it's also appropriate for us to adjust our prices to reflect cost of providing services so that we can have a sustainable industry. We can invest and reinvest and continue to provide services for the people.
Tell me if you think there's another way that the industry could be supported in the understanding that Nigerians are not happy about the prices going up. Would there have been a different approach by the government to support the telecoms industry to ensure that they can still provide the services while not necessarily giving a 50% hike on what they are offering?
Honestly, I wouldn't think so. Because of the socio-economic situation, the high cost of doing business around here, you know, if you may have followed some statistics, quite a number of fast-moving manufacturing companies actually left the country because they just could not cope with the high cost of doing business. So in our situation, I'm not sure there will have been other things that the government will have done to make things better, other than just to allow that operators will charge prices and rates that are commensurate with the cost of providing business. Remember also that we are private companies. We work only with private sector investment. We don't rely on government subsidy. In that regard, it is therefore difficult for government to fix prices.
So how do the telecom services and the pricing compare to those in other countries where the same operators are present? For example, MTN is present in much of West Africa, same to Airtel Africa, much of West Africa, Southern Africa and East Africa as well. When you look across board, are people in Nigeria, would they be paying more than the rest of the countries where these same companies are offering the services?
From available statistics, as of this morning, Nigeria charges the lowest rate on data services. And I'll give a few examples. 1 gigabyte of data, Nigerians are paying 39 cents, which is about 604 naira. In Ghana, for the same 1 gigabyte, they're paying 40 cents. Kenya, they're paying 59 cents for 1 gigabyte of data. And in Ethiopia, they're paying 68 cents. And in South Africa, they're paying $1.77 for 1 gigabyte. And in Zimbabwe, they are paying $43.75 for 1 gigabyte. So if I look at even this basic statistic, which is an open source data, Nigeria still has the lowest rate compared with other countries of the world. So if at the movement that we are going to have, which is like a 50% movement, we are still lower than many other African countries in the same region where we are.
So there is a plan to contest this in court. The National Association of Telecommunications Subscribers has vowed to challenge this decision in the courts in the country. How do you anticipate that this situation will unfold, and how will you as an industry handle the fact that you'll get sued for this move?
Yeah, it's their right to challenge if they so wish. But the fact remains that nothing has been done outside the regulatory instruments of government. Nothing has been done outside of the provisions of the Nigerian Communications Act 2003. And therefore, we have no concerns that the court will rule in our favor if they so decide to go to court. Because the parameters that have been used for the price review and price increases, they are justifiable by common market data. So in that respect, we have no concerns whatsoever and howsoever if any group decides to go to court to challenge this.
There would be many asking whether this will translate to improved quality of service, because people do tend to complain a lot that the network is not reliable, that the quality is not that good. Would the industry be able to guarantee that the service is going to be improving because the price is going up?
Well, that's now an obligation that we have as an industry to improve quality of services and user experience on the various networks. But I must also say that factors leading to poor quality of services are also traceable to rates that we were charging that doesn't reflect market prices. In essence, we were charging way lower than our cost of providing services. And so under that old pricing regime, it's actually difficult, if not almost impossible, to guarantee good quality services. What we have done in the last 24 months is basically to keep the light bulbs on, to keep the network running at the best quality that we could afford under the circumstances. So in the new dispensation, we now have a duty to improve on that. Not only do we have to improve on that, we also must do a lot more to bring in improved and new technologies to improve user experience on the various networks, and therefore to justify indeed that our plea for review is appropriate. So we're going to do a lot more in terms of investment. I must say that in the last 24 months, not many operators have done significant investment on the network, but that will happen in this 2025. And so we expect that we will deliver better quality of services and better user experience on the various networks.
Where do you think this leaves the very vibrant digital economy that Nigeria has, particularly driven by the youth? They depend on these calls, on this data to be able to earn a living, make content, come up with innovations. Where do you think this leaves them?
I think there are better days ahead. There are better days ahead, because the flip side is that if we don't do anything, the networks will collapse. You will start having rationed services. So the good thing about this now is that in the next dispensation, service quality will improve, availability will improve, penetration will be deeper, and I think we are all going to be in a better place from now going forward.
Benga Adebayo, the chairman of the Association of Licensed Telecom Operators of Nigeria. This is the sound of one of many children receiving the malaria vaccine on the continent. It's been 1 year since the launch of routine malaria vaccinations in Africa. Close to 10 million doses have been delivered to 17 countries, starting with Cameroon through a program at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. In total, an estimated 5 million children have been protected in those countries, which collectively represents more than 70% of the world's malaria burden. A reminder that 8 in 10 of all malaria deaths in Africa are children under 5 years old, and that translated to over 430,000 deaths in 2023. Now, 8 more countries are set to roll out the vaccines this year, but many others are yet to receive the doses. Why is that? Ross Bailey is the head of advocacy at Malaria No More, an international organization driving political support, funding and innovation to help end malaria worldwide. Ross started by telling me what's been achieved since the vaccines arrived.
We are delighted that we are now a year on from the rollout of the vaccine, which started in Cameroon just over a year ago. We've seen 17 countries now receive the vaccine, which is a fantastic deployment of two vaccines that were made available, the first one approved in 2021 and the second a couple of years later. The vaccine is hugely important. It really, really helps build out the toolbox of tools and treatments that can help us fight malaria. And we know from the pilot programs that have taken place so far that children who receive the vaccine, we see a 13% drop in overall child mortality and an even higher reduction in the number of children who, when given the vaccine, are hospitalized in the first place.
Talk to us about some of the ways in which you're able to measure that progress. You've talked about the 13% drop in the deaths of children out of malaria.
So the malaria vaccines, the two vaccines that we have, RTSS and R21, as they are most commonly known, have been in the works for many years. The partners working on it have worked incredibly closely with WHO, UNICEF and Gavi over the course of the last year to allow for their deployment. The organisations working on this endeavour rigorously monitor everything and work incredibly closely with the child immunisation teams and the ministries of health within the countries in which they have been rolled out. The rollout stage, which started last year in Cameroon, was preceded by a three-year pilot program in Ghana and in Kenya. And that is where we understand the impact of the vaccine on the all-cause mortality. What we have seen is early results from Cameroon in particular, who've had the longest to assess what's going on. And they are seeing these results really backed up from the pilot stage. So that's incredibly positive. We know what was being achieved at the pilot stage is now being achieved in countries as it's being rolled out further. I think the other thing is this is a huge endeavour. This is multiple millions of doses of vaccine across many different countries. So the work here has to be painstaking and rigorous. And what we've got is a world-leading global health bodies in WHO and Gavi and supporting organisations, UNICEF, PATH and others who've all been involved in this, really doing incredibly rigorous monitoring so that we know that the vaccine is rolling out and having the effect that we want.
Give us a better idea of how the vaccines are being rolled out, especially whether all children and adults get equal access to these vaccines, or how exactly is it targeted?
So the important thing about the vaccine is for those who are most at risk, which is children. So about three quarters, nearly 80% of the burden of mortality every year from malaria is children under the age of five, particularly children below 3 years in age. So this vaccine is going into the routine immunization programs. So children who are being vaccinated against the traditional diseases that we would know, measles, mumps, rubella, all of these vaccines that were so common used to, will now at the same pattern of vaccinations that are being delivered by health centres and by community health workers, the real first front line of health defence, are now rolling out the vaccine to those children. What's very important about this vaccine is they require four doses, and these doses have to be done at quite specific intervals. So that's another thing that elongates the process of understanding how it's being rolled out.
Ross, I'm wondering if there are any obstacles that are being encountered during this rollout, and particularly in relation to vaccine hesitancy, which is something that we talk about quite a lot, especially when a vaccine is still new. People still do not understand what it can do.
I think at the very start, you know, we did hear some stories of vaccine hesitancy, but I'd actually really like to dwell on two important things here. One is how you move past the ideas of vaccine hesitancy. And what's been really impressive in this rollout is the involvement of faith leaders, of community leaders, of a real push by national health leaders and international health leaders to refer back and demonstrate the safety that's been achieved as it's been rolled out. Another thing that I think is really, really interesting is that I think there has been real desire for this vaccine. What we hear from communities that we've spoken to is how keen and interested people are to receive this vaccine. I think that's in part because what it's doing is coming in and saying, this is another tool that we can utilize to help keep children alive. And when we see in the order of around 450,000 children dying, the vast majority of them across the continent of Africa each year in our world, people know that something has to be done.
Why is it then still taking over 1 year for the rest of the continent to receive stocks of these vaccines?
So it takes time to roll out any new vaccine program. Countries have to be prepared for it. There has to be training done for it. I think, again, it's not something where it's just one vaccination and it's done. The vaccinations that are achieved have to have sufficient supply in country, and then that has to be taken in from the manufacturers. It does take time, and I think everyone is keen to be able to accelerate it, and there are programs going on led by organizations involved in this, including Gavi, who are at the heart, and WHO and UNICEF, to try and work at how to speed up this process.
I'm wondering if cost is a hindrance, and whether you found it that African countries which have a big burden of malaria are in a position to afford these vaccines.
Cost is a factor in rolling out any health program. But what's really important about these two vaccines is the role of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which is working with UNICEF on the co-financing of these vaccines to make them available to countries at a cost that they are able to afford. Gavi receives its funding through multiple mechanisms, but particularly through donors, many of which are the G20 countries. This year, the G20 will be chaired by South Africa, the first time the G20 has been on the continent of Africa, and it's a really important message that must go out. The $9 billion that they are asking for this year, which is an incredible investment, really must be met.
Should we be hopeful that someday we will be able to eradicate malaria on the continent especially and elsewhere in the world?
Malaria eradication is something that can be possible within the next generation, but to do that it needs several things. It needs real political leadership, recognising that malaria can hold back the lives of so many children, it can stunt economies, it really needs funding. We've seen countries like Egypt in the last year be certified as malaria free, and we've seen countries like Rwanda make huge drops in their malaria case burden, 90% reduction in roughly about 6 years. Progress is possible on malaria, but we need the will and the funding to make it happen.
Ross Bailey, the head of advocacy at Malaria No More. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Imagine finding a place that connects you to your roots in ways you never thought possible. For many descendants of enslaved Africans around the world, Benin is becoming that place. This West African nation has joined a growing list of African countries offering citizenship to those who can trace their ancestry back to the transatlantic slave trade. During that time, several European countries played key roles in transporting millions of Africans to the Americas. Portugal, Great Britain, France, Spain, Denmark, and the Netherlands were among the most active. Most enslaved Africans were taken to the Caribbean and South America, with around 3.2 million arriving in present-day Brazil. In comparison, only about 300,000 were sent directly to what is now the United States. By offering citizenship, Benin is not only acknowledging its role in the slave trade, but also following in the footsteps of other African nations such as Ghana, who are providing a way for descendants to reconnect to their ancestral homeland. It's a move aimed at healing and offering a symbolic form of reparations to those whose ancestors were taken from the continent. Here to explain the law, which was officially adopted mid last year, is Benin's Foreign Minister, Olusegun Adejade Bakare.
I think the introduction of this law reflects what we would call a shared responsibility to reconnect with our history. Benin used to be the port of departure of millions of slaves. When it comes to slavery, most of the time we talk about this very dark part of our history by pointing fingers on other people. But actually, we as a current African living in Africa, we also have our responsibility. So this law comes as a response for reparation. We want to repair, and we need first of all to acknowledge our responsibility. We need to acknowledge the fact that our sisters and brothers who was deported in America, in Caribbean, etc., it was not their choice. So we as an African, current African, we have also to acknowledge that we have a responsibility. And our to repair our responsibility, to correct this, we have to open our arm to our sisters and brothers and say that they never, it's not a question for them to come and reclaim something. They have to come back home because Africa is their home.
Okay, so this law is quite recent, but do you have an idea of how many people have applied to get their citizenship so far?
So we have a lot of demand since we adopted this law. It was in July, and late in October, we passed the decree explaining the process. So we will be completely ready for implementation to start getting the first demand, etc., let's say in coming weeks. But I can already tell you that every single day we are talking about hundreds of Afro-descendants coming, knocking the door, saying they want to reclaim their citizenship.
Okay, so this is also pegged on them being able to prove and trace their lineage back to Benin, isn't it?
Not back to Benin, because actually Benin as a republic today have nothing to do with the different kingdom. Because if you look at, for example, the Yoruba kingdom or Benin, Benin Kingdom, or Ketu Kingdom. Actually, those kingdoms was across Benin and Nigeria. So today, it would be very difficult to say that, okay, you have to prove that you come from Benin as a republic. But we acknowledge the fact that if you can prove that you are a descendant of someone deported through slavery, no matter from where this person come from, you know, in Africa, you have the right to come and reclaim your Beninese citizenship.
So you did talk about Benin's role, or the role of these kingdoms at the time in the transatlantic slave trade. And you say the country is not shying away from that history. Do you feel that Benin has fully reconciled with this past?
We are on the way of this reconciliation. You know, it's because we need to recognize our own failure. That's why, you know, today we are opening, we are giving them, you know, citizenship. We are telling them to come and get back what is their property because they come from here. And I think it's just the beginning of the process.
So, Minister, what we want to hear is a message to people perhaps living in the US or in Brazil and some of those other countries, and they feel like they are the people being targeted by this law and this process. What message would you give them?
Our sisters and brothers, this is the time to come back and reconnect with their origin. The time has come for them to come back home, discover their genealogy, discover from where they come from. We are happy, you know, to create this connection. We are happy to welcome them back home. And together, African living in Africa and African living abroad, together we can build a very strong future for humanity from all Black people in the world.
That's Olusegun Adejade Bakare, Benin's foreign minister. This new law has been widely welcomed by Afro-descendants of the transatlantic slave trade from around the world. I'll tell you more about that in a moment, but first, I'd like you to meet someone.
My name is Gail. I live in New York City. I'm a regional program director. The company for which I work is contracted by the Department of Homeless Services. I absolutely love Benin. My partner and I went. He and I touched down in Benin Republic, and immediately I just had a sense of belong. I can't really explain that. It really was a spiritual connection.
As you just heard, that's Gail Creek, an African-American seeking Beninois citizenship. I had a conversation with her about why she wants to become a citizen. She began by sharing how she felt when she first set foot in Benin.
I felt, and that's the words that I use to the people there, I said, I have a sense of belonging. I feel like I belong here. When I went to the Tree of Forgetfulness and they told me I had to circle it three times, I just felt that it was the thing to do because I felt I belonged in Benin. It was a spiritual connection. I love the country. And strangely enough, I found a book that shows that there was a direct connection for people who left Benin Republic and went to the Caribbean, specifically to Trinidad and Tobago, where my foreparents also from. I found that out after leaving Benin Republic, and I said, I knew it. So when I heard about this, that's what I loved about it.
So as far as getting citizenship is concerned, what's the process like for you, and how far along have you started any formal processes of this?
I am in the infancy stages. So I am now in touch with the African ancestry because Benin Republic wants you to be able to prove it. I am even willing to see, like I said to you earlier, that there were people who had left Benin and went directly to Trinidad, where I trace my roots. I am going to go as far as it takes to see that I can really benefit from this law that the gracious president has now bestowed.
Have you encountered any challenges in this journey to reconnect to your heritage and hopefully one day settle in Benin?
No, I have not. And I don't really necessarily anticipate challenges, because when I came to Benin, the process to visit Benin was so easy and simple. I thought it was very advanced. The process to get the visa was absolutely smooth and easy. We got it online. We got it in no time. I want to say something like 48 hours, even if even that long. And I think that was a strong indicator that Benin is moving in the right direction. I want to be a part of that.
And what advice or encouragement would you give to people like yourself, you know, descendants? They could be living anywhere in the world. What would you tell them? But they do have some roots somewhere. You can find a connection somewhere to Africa, not necessarily Benin. What would you tell them?
I will tell them like I tell everyone. First of all, I tell everyone to visit the continent of Africa. I am actually also helping to facilitate a trip to the continent and one of the countries in Africa for my entire organization. So we have about 600 employees, and we've already put up the flyer because the CEO asked me to be the leader of it because she knows that I've already visited like 11 countries in Africa. I have a sister that lives in Africa. And she said, can you please, Gail, I need you to put it together. And we did. That trip is happening in 2025. So to answer your question, I would tell them to visit Africa. Visit the beauty of Africa. Visit the loveliness of Africa. Get your own narrative of Africa. My first trip to Africa dispelled every single sight I've ever seen on National Geographic. My very first trip. It was amazing to me because where I stayed, everything was just fabulous. And that was since in the 90s. So I would tell them, visit Africa. And when they ask me my favorite country in Africa, I always say, visit Benin. Visit Benin. It is a spiritual connection.
Many thanks to Gail Creek. Focus on Africa came together as a result of the work of many hands and heads. Blessing Aderuba in Lagos, Yvette Twagira Maria and Bella Hassan in London. Paul Bachibinga was a senior producer. Technical producer Chris Kuzaris was at the mixing desk. Andrew Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. The latest edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily, discovers how Somali refugees made sambusas a hit in Minnesota in the United States. I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi. Thanks for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt. For things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.